I used to march back in the 80s for Black Death in custody here in Melbourne.
What we're saying here today, and what's very clear, and what will be very clear to Bob Hawke and to people all over the world when they see their television screens tonight and tomorrow, is that we have survived!
Walk in those streets, marching for justice in this country, to stop Black Deaths in custody in this country, has done nothing. It's gotten worse. If it doesn't stop now, it's never going to stop, and we're going to keep losing kids after kids after kids. If we don't get justice now, when are we ever going to get it?
From Schwartz Media, I'm Ange McCormack. This is 7am. Donna Skerr has spent her life fighting for Indigenous rights. A member of the Stolen Generations, Donna's grew up seeing members of her family die in custody and marching the streets for justice. In 2022, she received a phone call about her own son, Joshua Kerr, who had died alone in a prison cell after calling out for help. Today, the mother and sister of Joshua Kerr, Donna's and Maggie, on their family's tragedy and why rates of Aboriginal deaths in custody aren't getting any better. It's Tuesday, March 5, and a warning, this episode contains content that some may find distressing. Donna's, you've spent the past few days at a coronial inquest into the death of your son, Joshua, while he was in custody. That's a place that no mother would ever want to be, and I really can't imagine what that kind of pain is like. I will ask how we got here in a moment, but I do want to first ask, what was your son Joshua like?
Oh, he was a larrikin. Beautiful heart, beautiful soul. And it'll pull pranks on you. Oh, he'll have a yarn with you and then he'll just have this smirk on his face and this laugh he had. And you just have everybody else cracking up laughing in the room. he was a beautiful kid.
He had a lot of hidden talents as well that we had no idea about growing up, like especially me and my sister. We came to find out that he had a great love for his art and his painting and drawings. And the way he would describe his feelings through his paintings was really a side that I never really saw my brother growing up, but as soon as I saw the expression in his paintings, in his love, in his dedication, and what his purpose was, he really did show us the great potential that he did have and possess.
What did you love about him as a mother?
Oh, I just loved him. He was so beautiful. He looked like a porcelain doll when he was a baby.
Did he?
Yeah, people couldn't tell the difference whether he was a boy or a little girl. It was that cute.
I'm sure he liked that description.
Yeah, he was just, Uncle Dick, he goes, "What's her name?" And I said, "No, Uncle Dickie, that's a boy, Josh." I said, "His name's Joshua." He was just, he was just a lovable kid. You know, he had a hard time in the system and being put in, you know, Malmesbury, Parkville. The system had chains on him.
Can you tell me a bit more about that, like what Joshua's upbringing was like and what it was like for you too when he was little?
Well, I was part of the Stolen Generation, so I didn't get to raise my boy. So he was 8 months when I took him to VACA. So I was actually living in Clifton Hill. I had a unit there, but I didn't really live in it because I resigned at Marge Tucker Girls Hostel. And then from there, when I did have Josh, I ended up at the Elizabeth Morgan shelter for women in refuge. I just couldn't look after him.
Because my mum being a part of the system growing up and actually being declared a state ward, they put the same statistics upon her and assumed that she would be like all the rest and just, you know, more or less leave us to the wolves because of that statistics that was there. And they just assumed that she, would be very much a part of that.
And how did that system impact Josh's life?
It didn't really give him a good start off, I assume, from the experiences that he was exposed to. Like the first traumatic experience my brother ever had was when he was placed in care. And during the care, he had witnessed a suicide from one of our other family members, which very much did traumatise him in that sense, where he thought, if I'm placed in a, you know, with a family that is trusted to make sure that I'm going to have a, you know, a healthy upbringing, a good upbringing, it traumatised him to think that his trust was very thin with a lot of people. And from the age of 10 up until he was about 13, he just retaliated in a way which exposed all of his emotions and his pain. From my mother's perspective, I can understand that it was a great sacrifice that she had to make in order to ensure herself and to ensure Joshua that he would have somewhat of a better upbringing than what she did. And that's where it became like a brick wall between them two in their relationship, where they really did butt heads. And I guess that's how, everything has fallen into place, and he has now become another victim to the system.
And how did you two sort of resolve that conflict?
I told him, I said, if I didn't love your son, you wouldn't know who I am today, you wouldn't know your sisters. And I said, you know, I loved you the day that I had to give you away. I said, you know, it ripped my heart out of me. He had this sort of understanding, but then it was like months later, he came back and he goes, Mum, he said, I don't blame you anymore. He could understand why, you know, I didn't raise him.
And what was it like when he said that to you, that he understood?
That was just like, wow. I never thought I'd hear him say that, because he was a wild kid, you know, he was a wild child. And for him to acknowledge that, and it was like, there was some mutual understanding of, you know, there was a bond coming together as a mum and son. You know, slowly, it was coming slowly. That would have been done, I suppose, but the system took his life.
After the break, the unanswered questions around Joshua Kerr's death in custody.
As a 7am listener, you value the story behind the headlines. That's why you should read Post, a free daily newsletter bringing you the top 5 news stories of the day, summarising each of their key points with links to full articles from a range of sources. Get the news you need to your inbox every weekday morning with Post. Sign up at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
The City of London in Andrew O'Hagan's latest novel is crumbling. But don't mistake this for pessimism. Instead, the author insists it's a necessary process for a better future.
Change doesn't just happen because it's time for a change. Change has to be forced. We live in the end not in countries that are settled places, they're just imagined communities.
I'm Michael Williams, and on this week's Read This, I sit down with Andrew O'Hagan to discuss his latest, Caledonian Road. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Joshua Kerr had spent time in and out of prison for years. In July 2021, he was arrested again, this time for an aggravated carjacking, and sent to Port Phillip Prison in Victoria.
I was actually told that he was only being there for a couple of months and then he was getting released. And in saying that, he was going to be released to a rehab. But that didn't happen.
Like many prisoners in Australia, Josh was held awaiting trial, but what his family believed would be a short stay in prison ended up being a little over a year behind bars.
So, yeah, he was on remand for the incidents that happened before his death, and that's when they, just more or less kept him waiting around in prison for a sentencing and... yeah, just during that time waiting, I guess it took a toll upon his mental state because here he was assuming that he's just going to fall in line upon the statistics that's just going to wait around in the prison just to wait, basically.
While he was in prison, Josh stayed in touch with his family, took courses and was planning for the future.
Yeah, he'd done all the courses inside prison. He's
barista. Barista. Yeah, he was a qualified barista.
Mum, I'm going to own a coffee shop.
Yes.
I'll have a coffee shop here and I have all my art there. Remember he said that? Yeah.
So all of his successful things that he achieved in prison, from the programs to the certificates, that's the greater hope that he gave himself while looking to the future on the outside.
Josh's plan to become a barista never happened. On August 10th, 2022, in an isolation cell, Josh lit a fire and was badly burnt. After being taken to St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne, Josh was returned to his cell. His family say he didn't receive adequate medical treatment and was overdosing on methamphetamine. On CCTV, prison officers saw Josh in his cell, calling out for help. He said, "I'm dying." Nurses attended Josh's cell 17 minutes after becoming unresponsive, but it was too late to help him. Joshua was dead, alone, on the floor of his cell.
I got informed by the police at 11:15 at night. I remember opening the door and then I remember looking at my phone at the time. And all of a sudden the police, it was two constables from the Northgate department. And I remember her just stating, "Is Donix Kerr here? We're needing to speak to her in regards to Joshua Kerr." And then that's when she started to say that my brother had suffered a medical episode. And when she said those words, I was just in a state of mind, like, convinced, is my brother still here or is he gone? And then that's when she stated the words that from that medical episode, it resulted in his death.
And at first it didn't hit me. And then she rang me back again. She goes, "Are you right, Mum?" I go, "Yeah, I'm all right." I said, "Why, what's going on, eh?" Man, it hit me then. I said, "It's Josh, isn't it?" And she said, "Yeah, Mum." And I, when she told me, I thought he was a life support or something in hospital. And then Maggie goes, "No, Mum, he's gone."
A coronial inquest in Melbourne last month examined the circumstances of Joshua's death, and Donis and Maggie spent 3 weeks sitting through it, hearing evidence and listening to expert witnesses. The inquest's findings are yet to be released.
It sounds like there's many unanswered questions around his death, and hopefully you'll get some answers from the coronial inquest. I suppose that's, you know, we have to wait and see what happens from that. But I guess to your understanding, how did Joshua die?
Well, my mum, she's not entirely aware of how my brother died, due to because I did see footage on how he died, and the impact that it has left upon me has been very dramatic. In other ways, the way he died, I didn't want my mum to see that footage whatsoever, to see the last moments of my brother dying like that. And now to know that my mum has some sort of an understanding on how my brother has passed away, yeah, I would never have wanted to watch the video.
And, Donis, what do you hope will come from the coronial inquest? Answers or what action do you hope it might lead?
I just pray and hope victory, because this is what this country needs. No one's ever been held accountable for no black deaths in custody in this country. And it's about bloody time. That would be the justice for my son, is to open that gate and say enough's enough. Our kids in the system are dying. Not dying because they're sick or they got a terminal illness, but people want to turn a blind eye on it. The different story if it was their son or their daughter. You know, where is this country really going?
I wanted Donis to ask when the last time you saw Joshua and what that was like.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. He gave me a big cuddle. He said, I love you, Mum. I said, I love you too, son. And he goes, I'm coming home, he said. And I said, yeah, we'll be there waiting for you.
If you need support, 13YARN is an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders crisis support line. For mental health support, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
From the Saturday paper comes The Food, a free weekly newsletter featuring curated recipes from some of the country's leading chefs, including Andrew McConnell, Otar McCary, David Moyle, and Karen Martini. Cook what they cook by subscribing today at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
Also in the news today, Walter Sofronoff did give the impression he was biased during his inquiry into the trial of Bruce Lerman by engaging in extensive text messaging with journalist Janet Ulbrichtson at The Australian before and during the inquiry, according to the ACT Supreme Court. The findings mean that while the majority of findings against the ACT's top prosecutor, Shane Drumgold, will remain in place, the court did say one finding was unreasonable under the circumstances. And Australia's housing vacancy rate has hit a new all-time low of just 0.7%, according to a study by real estate website Domain. The low vacancy rate is projected to ease in the year ahead, with projections more rental properties will come onto the market later this year. I'm Ange McCormack. This is 7am. We'll be back again tomorrow.